This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Ach, mein Schatzilein.
Mein Schnuckelchen.
Mein Mausilein.
Mein Schnurzel-Purzel-Knudel-Purzi-Schnurzel-Kuschelherzilein.
Für alle, die es weniger süß mögen, Fruchtinade von Spreequell. Mit wenig Zucker und in den natürlich fruchtigen Sorten Orange Maracuja und Grapefruit-Zitrone. Fruchtinade. Mehr Frucht, weniger süß. Jetzt probieren.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. In this strip-lit, chart-bedecked virtual room, we're joined by the world's leading experts who, inside half an hour, can tell us everything we might want to know about a burning issue of the day, which today is whether our love of meat is really a danger to the planet. And if you enjoy this podcast, you might enjoy some of our other episodes, including ones on vaping, vaccinations, and the British Constitution. That's three separate podcasts, by the way. You can find them all on BBC Sounds. We're often told that our diets are killing us individually. But might they kill us collectively? Climate protests came to Smithfield Market in London this week under the slogan of beef equals grief. So some simple questions this week. Is it true? Do meat eating and animal rearing contribute significantly to global warming and other environmental problems? And if they do, what needs to change and how might we go about it? Step inside the briefing room and let's find out. First, I want to understand how much meat we humans eat and how our habits have changed in recent years. Dr. Hannah Ritchie, from Our World in Data at Oxford University, has crunched the numbers from the UN Food and Agricultural Organization.
Globally, the largest consumers of meat are typically Western countries. So the standouts are the US, Australia and New Zealand. Argentina is also a large consumer of meat. So the global average is around 40 kilograms per person per year. So these countries are eating more than double, in some cases almost triple the global average. But when we look at low-income countries, for example, we see that that's much, much lower. So it's in the range of around 10 kilograms per person. So we see this relationship where the richer a country is, generally the more meat that it consumes. Nearly two-thirds of meat consumed in China is pig meat and pork. And then when we look at lower-income countries, we actually see that their kind of industrial production of meat is much lower, and there they consume more game or wild meats. When we look at total global meat consumption, over the last 50 years, it's grown by four or fivefold. And that's been driven by an increase in population, but also just an increase in incomes across the world. So we've seen quite a rapid growth in low to middle income countries where their economies have been growing. When we look at rich countries, we see that over the last few decades, actually, meat consumption in total has kind of stayed pretty constant. In the Western countries, there's been quite a big push towards meat reduction, and a lot of people would say that they're actively trying to reduce the amount of meat that they eat. When we look at the trends, like, it's not very clear that this is actually what's happening. So the total meat consumption is not really falling, but we see a transition in the meats that people are consuming. So in the UK or the US, for example, we've seen quite a big shift from beef towards chicken and poultry. Globally, the biggest outlier is India. We see this relationship where India is actually the world's lowest consumer in terms of per person. And from its income level, we wouldn't expect that. The reason for that is largely religious. Although historically a large percentage of the population would say that they were vegetarian, that's changed a lot. So a lot of people now in India would say they're not vegetarian. Culturally, it's ingrained there that there are lots of good foods that are not meat-based. We see much lower levels of consumption.
Hannah Ritchie. Now let's dig into the science. How much does meat and animal rearing contribute to global emissions? What's the beef with beef? Joining me down the line from Princeton University is Tim Serchinger, who is a senior fellow at the World Resources Institute, Tim was co-author of a recent report entitled Creating a Sustainable Food Future. Tim Searchinger, how do we actually calculate the percentage of emissions produced through livestock agriculture? In other words, what the animals consume and what they emit?
So that's a great question, and it's not easy, and there are uncertainties in this. The standard way of doing it is to look at all of the different emissions involved in the different parts of the production process. So let's say you have a cow, and that cow is emitting methane from the stomachs, mostly through burps. Methane is a powerful greenhouse gas, and you estimate that and you count that. The manure that is left or deposited on pasture sometimes generates methane. It more generates nitrous oxide, another powerful greenhouse gas. You estimate that, you count that. The fertilizer is used even on pastures. That fertilizer required energy that caused emissions to make the fertilizer. That leads to nitrous oxide. You count that. The crops that are often brought in as an animal feed, it also took energy to produce them, fertilizer, et cetera. You count that. Now, when you count all of that globally, you typically end up with a number that's in the order of 12 to 15% of greenhouse gas emissions globally. And then the question is, what about land? So that's where we think people have missed the story. More or less half of the world's vegetated land is devoted to agriculture, and maybe two-thirds of that is devoted to raising livestock of some kind. A lot of that land was historically forest or it was wetlands, and those areas had to be transformed, the forest cut down, the soils plowed to produce livestock products. And that releases a gigantic amount of carbon that was previously stored in the trees and in the soils. Globally, about a third of the carbon in the atmosphere today comes from that prior agricultural conversion. And we did something very, very simple, which is we said, look, how much carbon have we lost from vegetation and soils that we converted from forests and other things to produce each animal product, whether it's beef or dairy or chicken or whatever? And for every kilogram of that animal product, we estimate the average carbon loss. Now, those emissions are typically not counted. The reason they're not counted is that that is counting the cost of converting land that was converted in the past. And most people say, well, look, those emissions all kind of occurred in the past, so we're not going to worry about that anymore. But the fact is that if we weren't using that land for agriculture, it would regrow and we'd get that carbon back. So that means that every hectare of land or acre of land, if that's your preferred term, that is devoted to livestock product that was historically a forest or a wetland is one that has a cost. It's a cost that as we increase our food consumption, we clear more of that and that increases the carbon in the atmosphere. If we were to somehow reduce our livestock products enough, we could restore those. Now, when you factor in that cost, the amount of carbon that isn't being stored in forests and other natural vegetation because of our diets, we've calculated that the average European's diet causes of roughly the same amount of greenhouse gas emissions over 30 years as the average European's consumption of everything else. And about 85% of that comes from meat and dairy.
By consumption of everything else, do you mean literally everything else we do?
Yes, literally everything else. Mainly, of course, your energy use, the concrete that's used.
So it's a double whammy. It's the thing itself, the thing that you're now producing, the animals themselves, maintaining them and so on. And it's the opportunity cost of what the land would previously have been used for and its impact upon the environment.
That's exactly right.
Tim, how will population growth affect emissions if we carry on in the current way?
Yes. Well, from food, the basic issue is that because the population is going from about 7.5 billion to 10 billion by 2050, we're going to need a lot more food. And then on top of that, a couple billion people at least, we hope, are going to enter at least the lower middle class, which means they can eat more resource-intensive foods, which includes more fruits and vegetables, more vegetable oil, and at least some meat and dairy products. Now, when you put all of that together, you're going to get a big rise in greenhouse gas emissions. And we've estimated in the agricultural sector that as conventionally looked at, we're going to end up with around a 25% rise in our greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture, which, by the way, already assumes that we're making a lot of improvements in agriculture. But those level of emissions would be from agriculture alone and agriculture and associated land use change would be 70% of the emissions allowable in 2050 that are consistent with holding climate warming to about 2 degrees, which is the minimum goal.
Now, if I were to say to myself, I would like to switch to the most environmentally sustainable diet, which is consistent with my own good health, what would I choose?
Well, you would choose a vegan diet. I mean, I'm not a vegan. I eat meat and I eat dairy, and it's hard to expect everybody to become a vegan. So I try to just moderate my consumption and particularly avoid beef and unfortunately lamb, which also has a lot of environmental costs, although I really like lamb. But you would be a vegan. If you're a really poor person in developing countries, actually eating a little bit of meat is a really good thing to do. It provides a lot of micronutrients. And so we don't want, and it would be grossly unfair to say that the billions of people in the world today who eat virtually no meat shouldn't be able to eat at least a little bit of meat. But for us, we could do without it for sure and certainly greatly, greatly reduce it. And then people sometimes say, well, what would happen if everybody gave up all meat? And wouldn't that be bad? We wouldn't be able to use native grazing lands. We wouldn't be able to use wastes that a lot of animals eat. And there would be issues if we literally gave up all meat and dairy. But we're looking at a 70% increase in meat and dairy by 2050 on our present path. So that's not a problem I'm worried about. I'm trying to just hold down the growth in meat and dairy. And the reason for that is that even if every European doesn't eat any more meat and dairy product, 6 billion people in the world who eat almost no meat and dairy, or extremely little meat and dairy, are going to eat at least a little bit more. And that places enormous resource challenges on the planet. And in order to create the space for them to be able to do that, we have to curb our consumption. If every person in the world in 2050 ate the amount of beef that the average European and American eats today, we literally would not be able to all live on the planet. That by itself would just be too much. So we just can't all eat beef. That's basically the story. And the minimum that we have to do in the West is cut our consumption by about 50%, which will still be more than the vast majority of people in the world. That seems not too unreasonable.
Tim Serchinger. That's the background. But even if you agreed it was highly desirable, how might you persuade people to make a change? If I were the Secretary of State for Environment and Food, how might I encourage people in Britain to make their diets less meat-based? I was joined in the briefing room by Toby Park, Head of Energy and Sustainability at the Behavioural Insights Team, or the Nudge Unit as it's also known, and Laura Wellesley, Research Fellow in the Energy, Environment and Resources Department at Chatham House. Toby Park, what are the first principles when trying to change deep-rooted behaviours?
Well, when it comes to changing food consumption behaviours, really we think there's sort of three key elements. We need to make sustainable food a lot easier, i.e. more available, more convenient. We need to make sustainable food more appealing. In other words, we tend not to want to compromise taste and enjoyment, even for the benefit of the environment, etc. So it needs to be genuinely appealing. And we need to make sustainable food more normal, by which I mean currently vegetarian food does have this perception among meat eaters of being somewhat abstemious, a bit weird for other people. And we need to sort of crack that.
Nowhere in what you said there is any kind of notion that you've got to make it more moral.
Right. That often tends to backfire, unfortunately. If you sort of pummel people with guilt, we tend to sort of resolve that guilt in one of two ways. You might hope they stop doing the thing that makes them guilty, but actually we often don't. We tend to sort of ignore the message, ignore the messenger, and sort of evade the guilt in that way. And often that's actually not very effective.
Can you think of examples of that?
There's a fantastic study actually about eating chocolate cake. You put a bunch of people in a room of chocolate cake, you split them into three groups. One in the group you say, imagine how guilty you'll feel if you eat that chocolate cake. Another group you say, imagine how proud you'll feel if you don't eat it. And the third group, you don't say anything. The guilt group actually eat the most chocolate cake. They eat more chocolate cake than the people that weren't told anything. And actually the message of pride and positivity tends to work better.
Okay, so it's pride and positivity, availability, more appealing, more normal. Nevertheless, it's a big campaign that you would have to undertake. Laura, what kind of resistance could you expect to a campaign to try and get people to eat less meat or eat more of something else?
There's potential for resistance at all levels, really. A campaign, as I think you're imagining it, is likely not to go down that well. If you start with consumers, we do tend to have a bit of a reluctance to any messages about not eating meat. It's something that is seen as very normal, as natural, as often as fairly central to our sense of identity or cultural identity. From companies, it's a deep challenge to fairly embedded business models and strategies. So pushing a message of eat less of something does not come naturally to most companies. Equally, any questions around reformulation of products and, you know, labelling always comes with some cost implications. So there's often pushback initially from industry on that. But then when you come to policymakers as well, there's a real fear that this is not a politically tractable option. There's a sense that the public isn't on board with this, and that to push a message of meat reduction would be to risk future votes.
That's very interesting, because what you've posed is a kind of deeply embedded cultural response, which would then go with those people who would be likely to be badly affected by such a move, which says this is part of who we are. We have always been meat eaters. It goes along with a kind of a sense of our identity. Let's say I'm the Secretary of State contemplating this. I had to think about whether or not there's a strategy which can create a different identity.
Shifting identity is clearly very difficult, but there are small things you can do as well to make plant-based food or more sustainable food perceived to be more normal. So even right down to the sort of microenvironment in shops, canteens, restaurants, etc. So let's look at menus, for example. Quite often you'll see vegetarian options in a separate box in a menu, and that really exacerbates that kind of notion of differentness or otherness. And actually what you find is when you do that, meat eaters tend not to order those options. You start integrating those options throughout the menu as if it's just another choice, and actually ordering rates go up quite significantly.
Really?
Indeed. And the thing is, when you're trying to make a choice from a long list of options, it can be a bit overwhelming. We tend to adopt these sort of choice elimination strategies. We're trying to simplify the process of choosing. So one thing we do if we're a meat eater, we look at that and we go, well, the easiest thing to do is just ignore the vegetarian section. I'll focus on the burgers and the pies, etc. So it's really inviting that strategy and discouraging meat eaters from even considering it. Likewise, in a supermarket, why have product in a separate aisle that perhaps meat eaters aren't even going to go down? You know, put the bean burgers next to the beef burgers, put the soy milk next to the milk. And there is good evidence to show that those small techniques do actually, you know, modestly but meaningfully shift consumption patterns. So you can do small things like that. And obviously that's something that restaurants can do. But when you think about government action, well, maybe they can, you know, use their procurement powers to change the options available in hospitals, schools, government canteens, etc.
The way in which Toby broke it up originally, easier, more available, more appealing, more normal. Let's talk about how a government could help to try and make it more appealing.
So there are lots of different measures that government can do to, I guess, indirectly make meat more appealing by supporting different kinds of measures along what we call a spectrum of intervention. So from awareness raising through changes to the food environment all the way over to regulation.
Government can do a lot to influence industry. One obvious route to do that is through taxation. And now clearly that's not going to be a particularly popular option for everyone, but there are ways of doing it that can be more publicly acceptable and more effective. So, for example, the way we would suggest approaching a red meat tax, for example, would be very much to do it so that it faces producers and incentivizes reformulation and innovation in the sector. So rather than a conventional sin tax that just levies a cost on the consumer that wants to eat certain products, what you do is you set that tax at a particular threshold of, say, carbon emissions per portion, deliberately designed so that producers can avoid it by innovating, reformulating, adopting slightly more efficient farming procedures, etc., so that their emissions per portion drop, they don't pay the tax. And the beauty of that is consumers don't really need to do anything. The products on the market start becoming more and more sustainable. They eat the same stuff that's familiar, enjoyable, and so on.
I think most of us have noticed the phenomenon of a consumer-led move towards the production of vegan and vegetarian products. So much so that it's even begun to change the way in which they're described in newspapers and so on, because newspapers have taken them out of what you call the abnormal bracket and put them into a bracket of trendy. How does government go about assisting in a process like that?
One of the very live issues around that at the moment is how companies can label the new generation of plant-based products that we're seeing as meat substitutes. So I'm thinking here of things like the Beyond Burger, for example, which takes...
What burger?
The Beyond Burger, made by Beyond Meat, is an example of a a new generation, really, of meat alternatives. So it takes familiar products, plant proteins and vegetable oils, but it processes them in such a way that you get fibrous structures that are reminiscent of meat. And these new ranges, they are targeting meat eaters and they aim to displace meat. So they're not targeting vegetarians or vegans. And there's quite a live debate around whether those products can be called burger or sausage or meat-like terms. And it's an interesting one because the use of those kind of terms is fairly normal and accepted for us when you're talking about corn mince or a Linda McCartney sausage, for example. But you can see that there's a real concern from incumbent industry that the use of meaty terms is potentially encroaching on their space, that we might then start to see plant-based products marketed alongside meat products in supermarkets. So a pushback on labelling. So governments have a role to play there in deciding those rules.
Finally, to both of you, do you really think that we can achieve such a shift, Laura?
I do. I think that there's a lot of potentially very positive messages around a shift. So if we think of the huge upswell in public interest in climate change, for example, you can see that there's a move to taking ownership over big global challenges that will affect the ability of our future generations to live as we do. And I think recognising the role of food and agriculture in that opens the door to thinking about what our food industry could look like and how that could support a healthier population and how we can support farmers in transitioning to a livelihood that is resilient to the future, so both to changes in consumer demand and to the pressures that climate change will bring.
Are you as hopeful as that, Toby?
Well, maybe it's a little too early to say, but I am quite optimistic. We've seen time and time again that actually we're not very good at adopting pro-environmental behaviours. Most of us still fly, own big cars, big houses, etc. But that tends to be because the behaviour is quite hard. It's expensive to buy an electric car, it's difficult to give up flying, etc. With sustainable diets, we don't really know whether that's the case, because actually we could all change our diet quite easily tomorrow. There's no real major barriers there. So, you know, we're already seeing a massive uprising concern for the environment. Good options for vegetarians are coming onto the market every day. So I'm pretty optimistic. I think we will achieve it.
Toby Part there with Laura Wellesley, saying that at a national level it's difficult but not impossible. But finally, we'll go wider. This is a global problem with many possible solutions, but what might they be? Down the line is Professor Luis Fresco from Wageningen University in the Netherlands. Luis Fresco, what could we do to make livestock farming more sustainable?
Well, first of all, I think it's very important not to generalise about livestock. There are huge differences between grazing animals such as cows and sheep and intensive livestock production of chickens, for example, and the measures we can take differ actually quite considerably. So what we can do, for example, in dairy farming in the West is to really keep the cows inside as much as possible and use filters to filter out all the emissions. The emissions, of course, with dairy cows are mainly in nitrogen and not so much in CO2. So it's very important that we except that the devil is in the details here and that we don't go to generalizations about we must halve all livestock production. And if you look at a country like the Netherlands, we have decreased the amount of emissions from livestock already quite considerably over the last 10, 15 years.
That would suggest an intensification of what we call factory farming here in Britain. And that's been controversial in and of itself. Is that essentially what you mean?
Well, if you ask me just the technical measures, the best technical measures would be actually to keep the system as closed as possible. However, there are many reasons why people in the public would like to see animals roaming around and seeing them in the landscape. So this is a trade-off we have to accept.
Well, let's imagine for a moment that there is a point at which we can reduce a bit, but because of these other factors, we still want to maintain animals on part of the land. How could we manage that land better, let's say, across the world?
Well, first of all, I think it's extremely important that people understand that there is a lot of land out there that is not suitable for crop production because it's too steep, too dry, too high, or too infertile. That land is best used by keeping animals grazing on the land. And that's one of the reasons why we feel that one shouldn't really do away with all meat or all animal production. meat and dairy products do carry a number of nutrients that are quite essential, especially to an elderly population, and cannot be easily substituted by other things. The matter is to find the best possible combination of the use of the land and the type of the land. And we can manage things much better by making sure that we have the right density of animals. Of course, a lot of the problems in CO2 come from poor farmers in tropical areas who actually have to burn the forest or the savanna because they don't get enough soil fertility otherwise. And the density of animals on that burned land is often very low as one animal per hectare. So we can manage the land much better also in temperate countries like the UK or the Netherlands by making sure we don't get erosion, we have a good land cover, we make sure that the animals also get feed that actually reduces some of the emissions from the animals. We now know that feed in combination with the gastric processes, including the bacteria that animals have in their gut, actually determine a lot of the emissions.
You raised the question of possible substitutes. So how might we substitute?
As a start, I would say we should not do away with all animal proteins, and that includes also fish and not just meat or dairy. But what we want is to find the optimal balance. Animal proteins have the advantage that they have the ideal combination of amino acids and nutrients, which if you don't want to take it from animal sources, you have to find a really good balance. For example, the right amount of cereals plus leguminous crops, beans and lentils and so on. We actually think that probably the ideal situation would be that 2/3 of the diet would be from plant sources and 1/3 from animal sources in, say, about 2050. Meat substitutes are very popular now. The problem with that is that it requires quite high processing. And we feel actually that by doing away with all the fibers, you actually lose a lot of the advantage of plant proteins and plant products. So the ideal thing would be to go actually to eating the plant products in their natural form, as beans, for example, combine it in the right possible way, and add to that new sources of protein and a small amount of meat and dairy. A new source of protein could be other organisms such as algae, maybe even bacteria. Most of the meat in the world is actually consumed in a processed way. Meat in sauces, meat on top of pizzas and so on in cannelloni. If you substitute 1/3 of that meat by a plant-based source, people don't notice it. So the other alternative, of course, are insects. And now we have published the first insect recipe book in the world. But of course, not many people in the short term will be wanting to eat insects in a visible, recognizable form.
How would we go about doing this globally in order to achieve the reductions in emissions that we want?
Well, first of all, I think the aim should not just be reductions in emissions. It should be also health-directed. And secondly, we should optimize land use. And that means, for example, on natural grazing lands, say parts of Latin America, but also, say, Inner Mongolia and so on, those are areas where we should continue animal production and do it in the best possible way. That requires actually a plan at the level of every country. And it's quite surprising to me, frankly, that there's no country that I know of that has an integrated, say, protein or animal production or food policy that really states this is what we want to do and this is how we want to do it. That's quite amazing, frankly.
Louise Fresco. I suppose my conclusion about this is that moving away from a high meat diet does make environmental sense, that a strategy for achieving it would need to be globally flexible, and, most helpful of all, it won't be easy. My thanks to Hannah Ritchie, Tim Searchinger, Louise Fresco, Laura Wellesley and Toby Park. And we'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirstine Knight, Lizzie McNeil and Serena Tarling. And if you'd like to listen to more episodes, you can catch up by going to BBC Sounds.
Ach, mein Schatzelein.
Mein Schnuckelchen.
Mein Mäuselein.
Mein Schnurzel-Purzel-Knudel-Purzi-Schnurzel-Kuschelherzelein.
Für alle, die es weniger süß mögen, Fruchtinade von Spreequell. Mit wenig Zucker und in den natürlich fruchtigen Sorten Orange Maracuja und Grapefruit-Zitrone. Fruchtinade. Mehr Frucht, Weniger süß. Jetzt probieren.